For British philosophy of life is live and let live, but don't take the mick. Surely that includes not interfering with people's demonstrations, as long as they're not inciting violence.
But that's where the line exactly is, and I think it should be drawn. If you are inciting violence or supporting a proscribed terrorist group, that is unacceptable. Proscribed terrorist groups have one goal, which is to obliterate our way of life, and they do not have that same respect. Trevor, you've been so beautifully outspoken on this in the way that you have represented the need to have freedom of speech, but also there are repercussions for people when they cross that line. And look, you know, I was asked the other day about, is multiculturalism working in our country, and about the comments that Robert Jenrick made about seeing another white person on his street. We don't judge people based on skin colour. We're based on the values they have in our country. We will uphold our values, and when you breach them, you will face the repercussions.
Alicia Kearns, let's stop there because I am blushing. You can't see that, but you know. Thank you so much. That was Alicia Kearns, Shadow National Security and Safeguarding Minister. That is it from me today. I will be back at 1 o'clock tomorrow, but up next on Times Radio, and then in the studio with me, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you very much, Trevor. We salute you too. Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio.
Now, in the next couple of hours, the conflict in the Middle East continues. More airstrikes on Tehran today. We'll discuss whether the US and President Trump realise what they've started, in the company of the historian Sir Anthony Beaver. We'll also talk about rising oil and gas prices. What do they mean for your energy bill? MPs are voting on banning children from social media today. We'll get the view of the think tank, the Centre for Young Lives. And good news, potentially, for cat owners. Maybe, just maybe, cats don't hate us after all. Plus, the return of our popular. It's very popular. It's our literary salon. We do it every Monday. Laura Hackett is in the house, the book house, at about 3:30 this afternoon.
All of that happens after the very latest news from Stuart Willie.
Hey, thank you. Good afternoon. The Prime Minister has warned of the economic damage from the Iran crisis, saying the longer it goes on, the more severe it will be. Oil prices earlier climbed to $119 a barrel, their highest level since 2022. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, joined an emergency G7 meeting to consider a coordinated response, including releasing some petroleum reserves. Nick Butler is an energy economist and former head of strategy at BP. He told Times Radio a new urgency in Whitehall has come too late.
A week ago, people were expecting this to be a short and sharp conflict. Now it seems that both sides are digging in. Both sides are widening the war, and I think it will now go on for at least several weeks. And the implications, even if it stops this week, for the oil and gas markets will last for several months.
Meanwhile, Downing Street has downplayed suggestions an aircraft carrier is being readied to protect British interests in the Middle East. NATO air defences in the Mediterranean have shot down a second ballistic missile in Turkish airspace that Ankara says was fired from Iran. In Tehran, thousands of people have flocked to pledge allegiance to the country's new leader, Ayatollah Mujtaba Khamenei. Crowds held flags and portraits of the son of the former supreme leader, seen as a hardliner. David Patriarch Karakos is an author who's long written on Iran.
It is a middle finger to the United States and to Israel. Donald Trump, when asked about the possible elevation of Khamenei before this happened, said it was, and I quote, unacceptable. Second, it signals continuation, complete continuation, which feeds back to my first point. Thirdly, it means that the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard, remains firmly in control of the Iranian state. He's known to be very, very close to them.
In other news, the government says it's seeking a patriotic renewal of England's communities under its social cohesion plan. It includes measures to promote integration, tackle religious hatred and clamp down on extremist influences in places such as charities and universities. The Communities Secretary Steve Reed told Times Radio language is key.
It's very important where you've got people coming into the country. They should be supported to learn English, first of all, because that's in their own interests. It helps people get a job. It helps people integrate with society. If you're a woman and you're being subject to domestic abuse, for instance, and you can't speak English, you're isolated and you can't find support.
Counter-terrorism police have charged a 58-year-old man with crimes against humanity and torture against civilians in Damascus. The suspect, who now lives in the UK, worked for the Syrian Air Force Intelligence Department. He's accused of 7 offences connected to the uprising in 2011 and is due in court tomorrow. And the Culture Secretary says she'll review a deal to buy The Telegraph. German publisher Axel Springer's £575 million offer has surpassed the one put forward by the owner of the Daily Mail. For a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times Radio news briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Well, a very good afternoon to you. It's 2:04. Welcome to Monday afternoon. Jane and I would like to issue a joint apology. Both of us have got stinking colds. It's not the best thing for the radio, but please don't feel you need to stand well back. We don't believe ourselves to be contagious through whichever device you're listening to this. We'll battle on with the very best of British spirit, won't we, sister?
Oh, yeah. No, nobody's sympathetic. They couldn't care less.
No, they couldn't care less.
Two middle-aged women with head colds. But, you know.
But also, I think Sir Trevor had a little bit of cold as well. And it has led us to worry a little bit about the hygiene standards in studio on air here at Times Towers. And we've got the wet wipes out. And hopefully we won't pass anything contagious on to John Pienaar. So that is enough. But it does explain to you why we're just a little bit bunged up as we struggle through the afternoon manfully. For two women. We're going to start with the case against Gerry Adams, which is being heard in court today. We then make quite a leap to discussing just how much your cat might like you. I believe this is a story that had to lie on the slate over the weekend, Jane, because things were so busy on Thursday afternoon.
Yeah, Thursday was a little hectic, but we've always got time for a cat story. We've made time today.
Excellent. The social media ban for under-16s, is it actually going to happen? Well, we're going to talk to one think tank who just want to make the point that we might have gone well beyond the time at which we can say that any good on the social media platforms mitigates against the bad. After 3 o'clock, the historian Anthony Beaver joins us to discuss what's happening in the Middle East and beyond. He wrote a terrific piece for the paper last week with his thoughts about Donald Trump in particular. He believes him to be quite unwell in the head. More on that topic. We've got books with Laura Hackett. We do tech with Chris Stokel-Walker and money with Adam Shaw. We'll give a nod to the unease in the markets and what that means for every single one of us. Everything you need to get your week started. Top stories.
Yes, let's go. The most read stories on the Times website as we speak. At number 3, Heston Blumenthal. Why I'm closing my 2 Michelin star restaurant. As he prepares to close his award-winning London restaurant, the chef talks about his future plans and his life with bipolar disorder. The second most read story is police urged to investigate offshore fund linked to Andrew. Documents reveal that the former prince jointly owned a company designed to get investment from people he met while he was serving as UK trade envoy. And the most read piece on the Times website is Iran latest Keir Starmer warns of growing UK impact of conflict. That is the live page right now with news including the biggest single day spike in the oil price in 6 years. Donald Trump says that higher oil prices are a small price to pay for global security. Here is Hugo Rifkind asking the Times columnist and economist Paul Johnson if he thinks the same way.
They're quite a big price to pay. Higher oil prices, and they've touched nearly $120 a barrel this morning. I think they're a bit down from there now. If it's maintained there, it'll take, I'd have thought, at least half a point off growth this year. That doesn't sound like much, but that is quite a lot. That's going to create problems for the public finances, and it's going to make us all worse off. So I'm afraid I'm being as cheerful as usual, because I'm afraid there just is no doubt that if energy prices are up, the UK will just be worse off.
Right, that's Paul Johnson, and you can hear more of his chipper analysis of the economy every Monday morning on Hugo Rifkin's show between 10 and 1. It's worth saying the Chancellor is making a statement in the Commons this afternoon, and if it occurs in our time, we probably won't bring it to you live and in its entirety, but we'll bring you just enough
for you to get a real flavour of what she's been saying. I mean, let's face it, probably not going to be all that chirpy, but we'll bring it to you anyway. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You will need a digital subscription, and you can get one very easily by going to thetimes.com/subscribe.
Now, Keith suggests that we both share a hot whiskey toddy. It'll sort your head cold and make for entertaining radio. It's not that kind of station, Keith. Those kind of stations are available. We don't do that here at Times Radio. It's 8 minutes past two. A civil case brought by three IRA bomb victims against former Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams has opened at the High Court in London, where the men are seeking a ruling that he is personally liable for IRA bomb attacks in Britain in 1973 and 1996. Gerry Adams has always denied that he had any role in the provisional IRA. Well, let's talk to Kiva Quinn, correspondent with you, 105 Radio. Very good afternoon from us, Kiva. Can you just explain the background to this case and why it's only now coming before the courts?
Yes, so as we saw, Gerry Adams is at the High Court this morning after three men who were victims of bombings by the IRA between the 1970s and the 1990s, really, are bringing this civil action towards him. And what we're seeing is that in terms of a civil action, it's going to be looking more at whether they can prove or not that there is a possibility that Gerry Adams did have a senior role in the IRA, something that he has always strongly denied. And these proceedings are expected to last over the next several days. So it will be a long case. I think we're going to have to follow how it updates day by day and what comes out of those actions.
Tell us about the damages that they're seeking. It's just £1, isn't it? Why that approach?
Yes, well, the men who have took the civil action are looking more of a symbolic winning, I suppose, of £1. And it's because that they said they would rather have access to that legal declaration, I suppose, of responsibility and acknowledgement of their suffering, as opposed to any financial reward for what they have been through.
Is it a case, though, that has any precedent in law that might inform us as to whether, if they were to win, they could go for compensation, other people could come forward? Because obviously there were so many people who were affected by IRA bomb attacks.
Yeah, I mean, the case is particularly high profile purely because it tests the ability of victims looking into the use of civil litigation to try and find truth and justice outside of the traditional courts, criminal justice system, I suppose. So it's also happening against the backdrop of that Legacy Act, which is seeing a lot of civil cases and other actions in relation to the troubles here put on hold, essentially, until we can find out what's going to happen with that legislation. Although this one was allowed to proceed, people are watching very closely to see how it pans out, because will we then see victims of bombings and other atrocities that took place during the Troubles come out and take civil legal actions as opposed to going down the criminal route through the criminal justice system?
What are these men's lawyers alleging about Gerry Adams' role within the IRA?
Yes, well, the claimants and their solicitors are essentially alleging that Mr. Adams was a member of the IRA's Army Council, and they're therefore saying that he bears a liability, as much so as those who actually planted the bombs, for the injuries that they have sustained. Now, the defence, Gerry Adams and his lawyers are consistently denying that he has ever been a member of the IRA, and his legal team have actually previously tried to get this case struck out, saying that there is no evidence to prove that.
What kind of evidence could be presented during the case, do you think?
I think over the coming days we're going to see a lot of maybe historical evidence come to light. There'll be a lot of testimonies. It's going to be really varied, I think, in terms of what people are going to bring forward, but there will definitely be a significant amount of historical evidence and testimony regarding the command structure, perhaps, of the IRA.
And are we expected to hear directly from Gerry Adams?
That's something we'll have to see in the coming days, you know, whether or not he will choose to take the stand and speak out. We've seen in the past sometimes he does not do that. We've seen other times he does. So it's going to be an interesting week, I think, in terms of what this can do and what went moves forward.
Sure. And we're saying that it's three men who've brought this case. Are they anonymous for a reason? Are their identities not being revealed for a reason, or we're choosing not to?
Their identities at the minute, all we know about them is that they were injured in bombs in London and Manchester, I believe, between the 1970s and 1990s. Whether or not they're going to be identified again comes down to them and what they are willing to put forward. Sometimes in these cases, victims wouldn't want to be named. Sometimes for legal reasons, they perhaps don't be named, and it just really depends on the circumstances.
Well, it's an extremely important case and a very interesting one to keep across. Kiva Quinn, thank you very much indeed for that. Kiva is a correspondent with U105 Radio. We'll bring you news on that as and when.
We certainly will. Some interesting messages. This is from Tony. Oh, by the way, the WhatsApp is 0333 003 2353. Tony says, are you aware it's now virtually impossible to buy domestic heating oil? No supplier is even willing to quote, let alone provide any kind of delivery date. I suspect they're sitting on stocks and will only release oil when they assess that prices are as high as they'll go. For those of us in rural areas, this is a huge problem as we have no other means of heating. Well, if Tony's issue is also impacting you, let us know. I was asking you earlier if you'd filled your... You've got a beautiful car, haven't you? A Skoda Monte Carlo. I'm a driver of a beautiful Mini Cooper. This isn't a car show, but we both are drivers.
We'd love it to be.
We'd love it to be, yeah. I haven't filled up, but I am contemplating getting some petrol. What have you done?
Well, I'm rueing not having filled up at the pump over the weekend. Obviously, it's an incredibly fuel-efficient car, though.
So. Oh, yes, I know. I believe so.
To be honest, I've probably last filled it up. I don't really drive outside London. I last filled it up in about November, and there's still not very much room in the tank to fill it up. But I will not be alone in actually really objecting to President Donald Trump's assertion that a rise in oil prices is a small price to pay for peace. You know, to an awful lot of people, as our correspondent Tony says, you know, you're not against peace if you object to the fact that your life is going to be made incredibly difficult by a rise in oil prices. Yeah. And it's kind of setting the two things against each other. And for an awful lot of people in rural communities, for people who are stretched already trying to commute to work in their cars, this is terrible, terrible, terrible news.
It really is. Keep your thoughts coming this afternoon. 0333 003 2353. It's not all doom and gloom. We are talking about cat behaviour in a moment or two. I think it's worth saying. But AI has transformed the way in which wars are fought, and we're seeing it, aren't we, now in the war in Iran. I should also say that our tech expert Chris Stokel Walker is talking about all this at around 10 to 3 this afternoon on our programme. But what happens when you have robots who can make battlefield decisions quicker than the speed of thought? And will it ever be possible to regulate them? Today's The Story podcast looks at that in depth. Rosie Wright has been speaking to Professor David Leslie of Queen Mary, University of London.
It's interesting you talk about the geopolitical moment we find ourselves in right now, because many countries, the UK are doing this, they've promised to spend more GDP on defence. And I wonder, we've looked just back over the last 5 years of how AI has already sort of radically changed what's happening on the battlefield. How difficult is it now for those governments in planning for how they're going to spend on defence to defend against another country's AI in 10 years' time? Do we know now what we'll have to be defending against?
So I think the current geopolitical environment is much more complex than it's been in a generation. And I think ultimately what this means is there will need to be the development of more sort of, protective orientations in the development of defense and national resilience. And I think that what that means is there will be further development of AI in the EU, obviously in the UK and in other countries. What will be interesting to see is whether or not a kind of rights-based regional approach will win the day. And so there is a real question if the geopolitical winds will actually blow the development of the technology from a defense perspective to more regional values-based approaches. And I have to say that, you know, if the horse is out of the barn and these technologies are going to be developed, one would hope that they're developed in areas where human rights are a priority in ways that are rights-based and rights-preserving. When you have a world that's streamlined through automated decision-making, the role of diplomacy, the role of that development of international relations that defined so much of the periods of relative peace that have been experienced over the centuries, that may well be a thing of the past. And I think we should all be very concerned about that.
Oh, a little bit of a sound effect there.
Gosh, that's very sinister.
It was. I did say we were going to try and cheer people up a bit today. That won't have cheered you up, but that was Professor David Leslie speaking to the brilliant Rosie Wright. You can hear more on the Story podcast. That is one story told in depth every day. It's available for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, thank you for your text so far this afternoon, particularly about heating oil, which is quite a neglected area of energy discussion. Anne says, here in rural Norfolk, I'm still waiting for a domestic oil delivery. It usually takes 2 to 3 days, but it's already over a week. My oil tank is running precariously low, and it is my only source of heating and hot water. And Tracy says, my daughter looked today at the cost of oil for her and her husband's 1650s Yorkshire Dales home. She's been quoted 138p per litre. When they ordered oil early last month, it was 58p per litre.
Yeah, I mean, that is a jump. Quite a leap, isn't it? In fact, Ricky says as well, can you please mention heating oil has doubled to around £1.24 a litre from 65 pence just over a week ago. This affects 1.7 million homes instantly, and people never talk about it. So that's a lot of people at 1.7 homes. That's a lot of people living in those homes. A lot of people are adversely affected by this. The price just doubling.
So that, you know, it's a small price to pay thing. Yeah. Well, lots of people would be just seething about that, Jane.
Oh, let's just move on to cats. Are you ready for this?
Well, I'm kind of ready, but I'm not sure it's going to be the unbridled optimistic story that you're purveying it to be, is it?
Knock it down. Coming next on Times Radio, would your cat care if you lived or died?
See what I mean, listener?
Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
From 6 o'clock, we'll bring you the latest on the war with Iran and what it might cost us here in the UK.
William Hague and Kezia Dugdale are our leaders panel after 9 o'clock, and we've got a big Times Radio announcement. Mm. I'll give you one clue. It's aquatic. Find out more tomorrow.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel. Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Put a tool in Aaron Gemmell's hand and he can fix just about anything. Put his business finances in front of him and he wasn't so confident. A carpenter by trade, Aaron runs checklist property maintenance. He had all the right tools for the job, but not for his numbers. Invoicing, tax, paying suppliers, it all took time he didn't have. That's where Xero came in. Xero is the ultimate small business accounting tool in Aaron's kit. It gives him full control over everything financial, all in one place. As his business has grown, Xero has been a game changer, especially with meeting the new Making Tax Digital for Income Tax rules. It doesn't just help Aaron stay compliant, it gives him better visibility and control day to day. Xero even generates smart, professional quotes and invoices, which Aaron says gives him a competitive edge. Now Xero takes care of the numbers so Aaron can get back on the tools and get the job done right for his customers. With Xero, you can change the way you see MTD. Search MTD Ready.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes. Transform your kitchen or bathroom. Wickes has everything you need, plus all the finishing touches, from beautiful tiles and flooring to a wide choice in paint and lighting. Whatever you're planning, create the perfect space with Wickes.
Now, are you concerned about your child's screen time? If so, the new parenting hub from the Times and Sunday Times might help. You'll find a range of articles covering everything from the right age to give your child a device to what happens when you take smartphones away from teenagers. For expert advice and hands-on experience, you can go to thetimes.com/parenting. And we will be talking about a potential under 16 social media ban in the next half an hour of the programme.
Yeah, and we're also talking about energy prices in the company of our money man, Adam Shaw, before 4 o'clock as well. Nick says, if I lived in the country, I'd get solar and battery sorted out ASAP, if at all possible. We've had oil price shocks since the 70s, and we'll have them again, whatever happens in the next couple of weeks. Glyn thinks we're sounding bunged up. Here's one for the oldies. Could you both try saying I'd like a second-class return to Nottingham, please, in homage to the 1980s Tunes advert?
Yeah. Well, you managed it quite well.
We wouldn't pass the test, I don't think, really.
I'd like it. Well, the way that the advert went, yes. Yeah. I'd like a second-class return to Nottingham, please.
Right. Would your cat care if you lived or died? The fears of some pet owners were confirmed last month by a new study from a Hungarian university. Researchers there said they'd proven that cats behave the same way to strangers as they do to their owners. What nonsense. Dogs, meanwhile, passed with flying colours and showed their love for their owners. Let's have a bit of cat love with Daniel Warren Cummings, who's a cat behaviourist at the Cats Protection Charity. Hello, Daniel. Right, why don't you swallow this line from this Hungarian university?
Hi, great to be on to defend cats. But fundamentally, one of the big issues is that this study isn't necessarily looking at how cats bond to owners. It's more comparing them to dogs. The models that they use within this research originated from children and then to dogs, and now it's sort of being applied to cats. And we know that cats aren't small dogs, so we need to assess their confidence around people in a different way. I'm sure many of your listeners are absolutely screaming at the radio at the thought that their cat responds to them the exact same as a stranger would. That's crazy to a lot of cat owners out there.
Yeah, but you say that, but let's say I go away on a little bit of a mini break and I ask a mate to move into the house, and they may or may not be familiar with my tabby Dora, but within nanoseconds of their arrival, she's happily snuggled up on their lap and they usually send me a comforting picture to say, Dora's fine. And I think, oh, OK, so she doesn't really know this individual at all, but they seem to be providing her with water and kibble for the next couple of days, so she's happy with it. I mean, I'm sorry, Daniel, but I love my cat, but I don't think she is that bothered about me.
Well, this is actually a really good thing. So we look at that and think, oh, goodness, the cat snuggled up with someone else, therefore they're not as bonded to me. That's not the case. It just means that the cat was probably well socialised within the early socialisation period as a kitten and actually can bond well and cope well with other people. There's lots of cats that unfortunately can't. But that doesn't mean because they can bond with other people, it doesn't mean that they don't have a special relationship with yourself. And certainly many, many, many owners out there will realise that their cat responds very differently to them whenever they come home versus a stranger coming into the house. Now, that doesn't mean they always run away when a stranger comes into the house, but if you've come home and your cat's run down the stairs and they've got the upright tail and that meow that your visitor isn't always getting, that's an indication that they are particularly more bonded to yourself.
Right. I need to bring in my colleague here because I've only got one cat, but Fee, I mean, Fee's got form with felines. How many have you got?
We've got three cats.
Right.
And we've got a dog. And I would honestly struggle to say that there's a difference in their loyalty and their love based on which species they are. I think it does just have way more to do with their character. Mm. We've got a very rogue teenage cat called Brian, and there's just nothing that he can do consistently, and that appears to mean liking people as well. And we've got a huge hound who actually should be fiercely loyal to just me as her owner, because she's a rescue dog and she used to be raced, and they are, you know, they become notoriously bonded to their trainer. But I mean, she would happily go off with Jane. Anybody in the park should just go, yeah, they love me, off I go. Yeah. So it doesn't, I'm struggling to see a definitive here, I suppose.
Andy says, our cat Coco used to punish us when we got back from holiday. He'd purr, first of all, and then spend 2 days scratching at us and mewling. Well, there you go. I mean, cats don't like it much when you go away, actually. I can relate to that, Daniel.
cats experience a lot of boredom and frustration. And on the more serious side of a study like this is sometimes, unfortunately, it gets misinterpreted as cats don't need as much attention or don't need people around a lot. And then, of course, somebody adopts a young kitten in their work and say 9 to 9. And then 3 months in, they're having all sorts of behavior problems and that cat ends up abandoned or relinquished. And that's sometimes the way we interpret studies like this. It then shifts our perspective of, oh, how do we actually look after cats and have good cat welfare? And that's something that we want to be really sort of mindful of, that we are sort of saying that cats are different from dogs, but they can form bonds. They can feel more confident when they're around people that they have a relationship with, but they still need that attention. And that's why often cats are left, maybe just with the cats that are popping in for 15 minutes. They're going to have lots of energy that's built up that they're not getting out. Of course, their known person comes home. Okay, that's fantastic. You're back. Now I'm just going to let all of this energy out, whether it's sort of climbing up the curtains or scratching or doing otherwise.
Yeah, okay. I mean, how can you tell, by the way, because I don't think I do know, when a cat wants affection? Is it when they approach you? Is it ever okay to pick a cat up because you fancy stroking them?
We generally recommend the cat's protection not to pick the cat up unless you have a good solid bond with them. I'll pick my cat up if I need to, but I know we've got a good bond with her. But in terms of how do you know when they want affection, generally walking towards you is a good sign when they do all that sort of cheek rubbing up around you. But watch for the tail. If the tail is upright and a really relaxed, almost a question-like position on the tail, that is a generally happy, confident cat that's approaching you and going, I'm happy. So even if they haven't necessarily come directly towards you, if they're in your vicinity and you're getting that nice relaxed tail, the tall body posture, they're pretty comfortable with you. You could go in and give them a little cheek scratch or whatever fuss you know that they like.
Yeah, okay. And do you have a view on the difference between a house cat and a cat that does come in and out? I mean, is there an official cat's protection line on all this? Is it okay to be a house cat?
Fundamentally, at Cats Protection, we want to say give cats choice. And that's the really important thing. Some cats will have choice to go outside, but never use that choice. And that's fantastic. Lots of cats, unfortunately, have that choice taken away from them. We do try and encourage owners to do it responsibly. So, for example, we encourage owners to keep the cats in overnight, so from dusk till dawn. So the cats are still having the choice to go outside during the day, but if they're kept in overnight, reduces harm to the cat and can reduce predation as well. So it's that balance of responsible pet ownership without impacting on the welfare of the individual cats or other animals as well.
Okay, but the bottom line, and one we're clinging to here, in a world of pain, cats do love us and we need to love them back. Is that fair, Daniel?
Absolutely. Cats are such a source of comfort, especially in times like these, listening to sort of what's going on in the world. Your cat is away from all of that. They don't pay attention to any of that. They're just there. And if you have a bond with them, it can be one of the most sort of therapeutic and relaxing sources for people in times like this. So very much so. Cats form great companions both ways.
Hear, hear. Thank you. Daniel Warren Cummings, who is a cat behaviourist at the Cats Protection Charity.
I rather feel for the nation's cats at the moment then, Jane. I think that they're all probably meeting in secret in Cat Club going, God, when are they all going to stop taking it out on us? Expecting us to make them feel better? There's nothing we can do.
No, I'm afraid not.
He's out of control. Do you wish that Dora did go out a bit more?
Oh, how dare you pick on her. She went out yesterday I must be getting on for 20, 25 seconds. She's just testing the air. It's not warm enough yet.
So she is a cat who's just chosen to live indoors, hasn't she?
She doesn't have to at all.
You'd quite like her to go out a bit more.
Well, I'd like her to, shall we say, use the outdoor facilities rather more than she does. But summer's coming, isn't it, eventually? And then she'll be back out under her favourite tree and doing the things there. Thank you, Dora. Thank you very much.
Right, light and shade, that's enough.
Okay.
Coming up, could Britain actually see MPs vote to ban social media for under 16s? That's where we'll go next. It's just gone 2:30. Latest headlines now with Stuart Willey.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer admits the longer the conflict in the Middle East goes on, the more likely it is the UK will face economic damage. Oil prices are at their highest since 2022, with the average cost of a litre of petrol increasing by 5p since the war began. Chancellor Rachel Reeves will update MPs later on the government's response. Katie Prescott is the Times technology business editor.
Analysts at Goldman Sachs in the city who look at these things day to day say that oil prices could go higher than the $146 a barrel record that was set in 2008. And that's if traffic through the Strait of Hormuz, that narrow little gap of water between Dubai and Iran, doesn't recover before the end of the month.
Mm. Meanwhile, Downing Street is playing down suggestions. The aircraft carrier HMS Prince of Wales is being prepared to deploy to the Mediterranean as the conflict continues. Elsewhere, Scotland's First Minister says a fire that's closed Glasgow Central Station has caused enormous damage. The dome of a 19th century building nearby that houses a vape shop has partially collapsed. The High Court has heard Gerry Adams was complicit in IRA bombing decisions. The former Sinn Féin president denies having any role in the provisional IRA in a civil case brought by victims of separate attacks. And a 30-year-old woman is being questioned after several gunshots were fired at the pop singer Rihanna's home in California. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Hello, Greg James here.
And I'm Seema Pankhania.
And we're the hosts of The Tesco Kitchen.
Every week, Greg and I invite a culinary powerhouse into the kitchen to cook a recipe that really means something to them.
Hold on to your hairnets, because this week we're joined by chef, musician and host of Big Zoo's Big Eats. You might have guessed it. It's Big Zoo.
Zoo is taking us on a trip down memory lane and showing us how to cook the lasagna that changed his life forever.
It's live right now on YouTube, so get involved.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in Breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Let Wix install your new kitchen. Choose from a wide range of kitchens and add the option of installation to your order. For complete peace of mind, all installations include a 2-year workmanship guarantee. Get started by booking a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
So Nicola is in lovely Hungerford. Where's that, Jane?
Berkshire.
Thank you very much. Hello, Jane and Fee. My neighbour's cat is called Dora. We call her Explorer Dora. Frequently in our garden, sitting on our Jeep in the drive. She's lovely. Mm. Well, there has to be a lovely Dora out there somewhere. It is 2:34. MPs will vote on banning children under 16 from social media this afternoon. The measure is expected to fail, but ministers insist they'll act quickly when a consultation report comes back. Laura Trott is Shadow Secretary of State for Education, has been speaking to Anna Mikhailova, Times Radio's political editor.
The problem that I have with this is not a document which is saying how do they implement a social media ban for under 16s. It's whether they do one at all. And I'm sorry, the minister standing up and saying they will act decisively once they've decided what to do is absolutely preposterous, and it does not meet the scale of the challenge that we need to right now. Because I did a press conference with Kemi last week with bereaved parents, parents whose children have lost their lives due to social media, and their group is growing every single week. This is not a danger which is just posed to children who already have problems. This is a danger to every child up and down the country. Because if people saw what was on these social media feeds, they'd be out protesting in the streets.
Well, that's Laura Trott, Shadow Secretary of State for Education. Now, when we talked about this on our podcast off-air with Jane and Fee, our listeners in Australia, and we've got loads of them, sent in their takes. Social media is now banned for under-16s there. This was a pretty representative example.
Hi, Jane and Fee, calling in from Sydney. Having been prepared by the kids' schools for a pretty bleak holiday in front of us, and the kids having all got the actual telephone numbers of their friends, I can quite frankly say there's been no change and no impact to what they can access and how they use their phones over the holiday period, and no follow-up from any of the companies.
Okay. Well, Haroon Chowdhury is Chief Executive at the Centre for Young Lives and joins us now. Haroon, can we go back to Laura Trott's comments there? Are you broadly in favour of what she's saying, which is essentially, get on with it, the time is now. Why are we waiting for a consultation report to come back?
Good afternoon and thank you for having me. I think one of the things that we have recognised in our report is that there is a danger in the kind of conventional policy-making approach of, well, let's wait until we have better evidence because the evidence that we've got isn't quite conclusive enough. In most circles, in most spheres of policymaking, that might do the job. But in the context of social media, we've got an issue where the product is rapidly evolving and policymaking can't keep up. Harms are being incurred in real time while evidence and research take years to develop. And the tech platforms themselves sit on much better evidence than researchers and policymakers have access to. So in that situation, waiting and see until we get better evidence, until we get more conclusive evidence, doing all the consultation we need to do, that might sound like a neutral and objective approach to policymaking. But in this case, it's frankly neither. The way that I would frame this issue is very much one of a burning platform. When you're on a burning platform, you need to do something now to get off it. So in that sense, we support the proposal to implement minimum age restrictions for harmful social media apps. That's a very useful first step. That's a step that we can do now to pause the harm and buy the time to do lots of the other reforms that are also needed. What we're not saying is that this is a magical solution that is going to fix every problem.
Sure.
No measure on its own can do that. But it is a useful first step in as part of a wider package. And our report today is calling for a few other things as well that also need to be done. But this is a thing that can be done now to reduce the harm now, while we buy ourselves the time and the breathing space to make all the other reforms to social media that also need to be made.
I think one of the most interesting points that you made, Haroom, is the fact that these tech companies are sitting on evidence. They know what it is that's on their platforms. In a sense, many of us as parents, and I'm sure many politicians feel the same way, that we are playing catch up with that knowledge. And essentially, that's what is... That's a morally bankrupt place to be, isn't it?
Well, it's not a level playing field, and it puts us in a position where, quite frankly, how do you regulate an industry where the industry has all the evidence on whether or not it's harmful? That doesn't make sense. That's completely back to front. And that's one of the reasons why we think that the evidential test that's being applied here is the wrong one. As far as I can tell, the onus seems to be on researchers and pressure groups to prove that social media is harmful. I think we need to shift the burden of proof. The onus should be on the tech companies themselves to prove that their product is safe. And actually, that is the approach that we take for every other consumer product that children and young people and families are using. You cannot put a product on the market until you've gone through the process of making sure that it's safe and sharing that information and evidence with regulators. We seem to have unwittingly created a special exception for social media apps where they can be made available for children to use for hours on end without having to go through any of that process whatsoever.
Sure.
That's one of the things that we need to do to make this a fairer and more level playing field.
So what is the thing that a government could do that would actually force those tech companies to make the evidence available so we weren't wasting time on this catch-up of consultation? And if we are going to make comparisons to what we've learned from similar situations in the past, and the comparison is always made, isn't it, to the tobacco industry, what's the main role of government in all of that?
Well, I think that you're exactly right to draw that parallel. What we're calling for is a public health approach and a precautionary public health approach. And that means that, first of all, if you've got a product that is harmful or addictive, in this case, both, you need to protect those who are the most vulnerable, including children, from being exposed to it. And that is not about punishing children. That is about putting a liability and an obligation on companies to make sure that their product does not get to children. The other thing is that I think there is a big role here for just the requirements, that there's got to be a stronger regulatory framework here for social media companies that says, in line with other consumer products, you are simply not allowed to make this product available to children and young people unless and until you have demonstrated that it is safe. It is safe for consumption. And now how we get there would be a matter for the relevant authorities, including DCMS and Ofcom. But this is really about bringing social media in line with every other product that we, every other good and service that we consume. It cannot be beyond the kind of wit and wherewithal of public policy to make this happen.
And certainly any other product that we know harms children. I mean, that ship has sailed, hasn't it, where we're having a debate about whether or not it harms children. It harms children. There are too many families who have lost their children for that argument to make any sense at all. And I think the massive problem, and I'd be so interested to hear your thoughts about this,
room is that an awful lot of parents simply don't know what the content is. And I wonder, again, what the role of government should be in actually flushing out some of the sites, the images, the messaging. If we all saw it, I think it would really help distill the argument, don't you?
That's certainly part of it. We know. I mean, we've been involved in a campaign called "Big Tech Little Victims," which has been online, showing parents and grown-ups some of the things that children are being exposed to. If you just show them if you set up a blank profile on social media from scratch and show them, instantly, you know, without following anyone, you get bombarded with content that contains sexual references, contains content likely to kind of aggravate body image issues, content about mental health and self-harm, boys more being likely to be exposed to kind of politically extreme content, socially extreme content, misogynistic content. So there is all of this out there that gets pushed to you whether you seek it out or not. So you know, the algorithms push to you content that is more likely to be shocking, more likely to be kind of attention grabbing, more likely to be frightening, because that's what elicits a reaction, because that is what the tech platforms, their business model thrives on. Now, the Online Safety Act has, you know, when it is fully implemented, it will have measures to crack down on certain types of content, like illegal content, and the most kind of inappropriate content. But there's lots of other content that doesn't quite meet that definition that is still harmful in terms of aggravating body image or creating other risks for people. But the other really important point here is that the content is problematic. That is absolutely undeniably true. But the content is only half of the issue. The other half of the issue is the features of the platforms themselves. So the devices, the things that they use to keep you hooked. And that's not really about the content. It's about the constant notifications, the unread notification badge. It's about the numbers and likes and followers you have, which turns attention gathering into a kind of a point score and a competitive sport. These algorithms that will show you manipulate you into keeping on watching, regardless of whether it is you're looking at. And so that the whole apps are designed to be addictive, and you could be looking at flowers and puppies, but it's still the same mechanisms are at play to keep you hooked. And the infinite scroll through short form videos and posts from accounts that you're not even following, that all gets chucked in. So the idea is, you know, the apps are designed in a way that, you know, that you can't leave them alone for more than 5 minutes. And when you do open them, you can't use them for less than 5 minutes. 5 minutes becomes 20 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour. That is about how the apps are designed. And that is a problem regardless of what content they are showing up. Yeah. And so that's why you need this dual approach of saying we need to tackle both of these things to make these apps safe. And until you tackle both of these things to make these apps safe, you should not be allowed to give this to children.
Somebody reminded me the other day, Haroon, that there was a time when Twitter first launched where you could catch up with Twitter. So you go to it at the end of the evening and you just scroll through the accounts that you followed, and then it would send you a message saying you're all caught up. I mean, that just seems extraordinary in the hinterland of our memories now, but it proves that exactly that kind of ability exists within a tech company to put a lid on what we're watching and how much we're watching. What happens now then? I think so many people will be listening this afternoon saying, God, it's yet another interview about the passage of something through Parliament, and are we going to do this and are we going to do that? What happens next?
Well, as I understand it, the issue is being debated in the Commons later today. We'll wait to see how the government responds to the Lord's Amendment. It may or may not result in a vote. I think that there may be some... The government might say, well, look, this is an issue we're already addressing via the consultation. I think the point that we would make is that this is not an issue where waiting and being more considered about how you do things is a neutral and objective and evidence-based thing to do. There is a time cost here, and we need and some degree of urgency is required in order to address harms that we know are ongoing. I think we've learned from the Australian example, whatever its imperfections may be, we know that it's doable. We know that something is doable, and that the thing that is doable will then create incentives for tech companies to respond in some way, because the fact of the matter is that they are vehemently against this proposal. That means that if there's a way for them to become exempt to it, they would surely do it. And that way to become exempt is to do the work to fix the apps and make them less harmful and addictive.
Thank you very much indeed for your time this afternoon. That's Haroom Chowdhury, who is Chief Executive at the Centre for Young Lives.
And the programme was Molly versus the Machines,
and it's now available on Channel 4 if you want to have a look at the life and times of Molly Russell. It's one of the most powerful things I've ever watched about how the younger generation is trying to manage this extraordinary thing that's been thrown at it. You know, no other generation will have to go through what Molly's generation went through, because they were absolutely at the frontier, and in a way they were guinea pigs for the tech companies, and it's such a difficult, brutal watch, but it is well worth it. We all just need to be informed about it, Jane, otherwise it won't change.
No, that's absolutely right. Chris says, and it's a good point, why has heating oil doubled in price for oil the suppliers and distributors already had? And will the price drop as quickly? Well, what do you think, Chris? I think the answer to that is no. But it is, I hadn't realised, I confess my ignorance here, I had not realised so many people were dependent on heating oil, and I hadn't thought through that it was going to double in price as quickly as it has done. So lots of people affected. And to the messenger who said, why don't people in these lovely houses just have solar panels put on the roof and they'll be absolutely fine? Paul says it's very towny to suggest owners of 16th century houses use solar and wind power. They wouldn't get planning permission to put panels or wind turbines anywhere near an old building. It's like when townies tell us to use public transport when there's one bus in each direction every day. Right, you're very welcome to take part in the programme. We can just disagree, but in an amicable kind of a way, knowing that we'll still be friends at 4 o'clock. It's 0333 003 2353. Next, could that new remote worker you've hired actually be in North Korea? It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
The Evening Edition with Kate Borsay on Times Radio, hosting an honest conversation about current affairs, well-being, lifestyle, health and wealth. Plus, don't miss Tomorrow's Home, highlighting how you can make your house more energy efficient. The Evening Edition with Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio, with the UK government's boiler upgrade scheme. You could upgrade your heating with a £7,500 heat pump grant. Visit gov.uk/cleanenergy to check eligibility.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Hello, Greg James here.
And I'm Seema Pankania.
And we're the hosts of the Tesco Kitchen.
Every week, Greg and I invite a culinary powerhouse into the kitchen to cook a recipe that really means something to them.
Hold on to your hairnets, because this week we're joined by chef, musician and host of Big Zoo's Big Eats. You might have guessed it. It's Big Zoo.
Zoo is taking us on a trip down memory lane and showing us how to cook the lasagna that changed his life forever.
It's live right now on YouTube, so get involved.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Everything's computer.
It's the tech news, and Chris Stokel-Walker is standing by. Now, North Korean fraudsters are using AI voice changers and fake IDs to trick Western companies into hiring them, according to Microsoft. And the scammers apply for remote IT work, and then once they're hired, they send their money straight back to Kim Jong-un's regime, with some even threatening to blackmail their employers after they've been fired. Let's talk to Chris about this. First of all, how do these, how do these entities get hired in the first place, Chris?
Yeah, good afternoon. It's through a kind of combination of the way in which we have changed how we work. So increasingly, we are either remote or hybrid, and so you don't necessarily need to come into an office, which means you don't actually have to show your identity to a real person and be seen as existing in real life. And then also, that has been enabled even more by the rise of AI tools that can change your appearance, change your voice, and allow you to very quickly answer difficult questions such as, well, where exactly do you live and what is the weather like today? And by the way, can you maybe hold up a copy of the newspaper or something like that in your home city, which we believe to be, in this instance, probably the US, whereas actually they are based several thousand miles away.
And when they are fired, if indeed they're fired, what happens then?
Basically, they get reported to authorities, and there are some conflicting numbers in terms of quite how big an issue this is. There was a report last year by the UN which has identified that there are low numbers of thousands. We're probably not talking about tens of thousands of individuals who are being put to task by the North Korean state to try and bring in money that then, of course, allows them to sidestep sanctions, because often this money will be paid into a proxy bank account, or it might even be, for some companies, paid through cryptocurrencies and therefore doesn't come under the traditional banking rules that mean that you can't interact with North Korean enterprises in any way. And then that allows them to effectively fund their regime and to continue to operate, and also build up a sort of cybercrime capability that brings in even more money. So it might seem a little bit innocuous and a little bit embarrassing, but actually has big impacts.
Loads of people, particularly the younger generation, love remote working. It really suits them. But, I mean, I guess this is another illustration that there are real dangers with it.
Yeah, it's the fundamental lack of being able to interact with people in person. The conversations that you have at the side of a desk or while you interact in the tea room or something like that, all of those are really valuable things for young workers to be able to kind of build experience and to understand what is going on in the world of work, to improve their social skills. But also, on the other slightly more pragmatic side of things, it allows you to identify either slackers who aren't actually doing their job or people who pretend to be others that they aren't necessarily. And both of those are real risks. We've seen in the sort of post-COVID era a rise in, for instance, software engineers also using AI tools to be able to do multiple jobs at the same time. So it's not just North Korea doing this. It is actually people within Western cultures and societies as well who just want to get two or three salaries into their home.
Right. Let's talk about Caitlin Kalinowski. Now, she's an important woman. She had been leading hardware and robotics operations teams at OpenAI. She's quit, and it's quite the quitting, actually. What has she said?
She's been extremely outspoken, Jane, about the concerns that she has around OpenAI's closeness with the US government. So in the last week and a half now, obviously all that we've been talking about effectively is the situation in Iran, and we have seen the use of AI to try and launch those attacks. So for the second known time in recent history, we have an AI company's work being used to try and aid a US military operation. Now in Iran, previously we saw it back in January with the capture of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. And that argument between Anthropic, which was an AI company that was used within the US government, and Donald Trump and the Department of Defense, caused a big old blow up. Anthropic was basically declared company non grata to the US. In their place, OpenAI said, well, we will come in and we will work with the US government, with some caveats, but not as many necessarily as Anthropic had. And that has caused deep concern amongst many OpenAI staffers. But Caitlin Kalinowski, the first person to really put their head above the parapet and say, this makes me just very uncomfortable, and so uncomfortable, in fact, I'm going to quit the company.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite something, actually. She says that there's a lack of guardrails. I mean, potentially, in layperson's terms, Chris, what was it that she was really concerned about?
I think it's that military application. So one of the disputes that we've seen over the last week or so is over supposed red lines between the AI companies who want to instill those guardrails and the US government that wants to reserve the right to go through them. So two major ones. One was the unlawful surveillance of US citizens, which was a big one for Anthropic, a huge stumbling block that and ultimately blew up their relationship. And then also the out-of-human loop use of AI. So no human oversight in AI targeting or weaponry or any sort of military action. Again, Anthropic very queasy about that, and also
OpenAI. But OpenAI has traditionally been a little bit more pragmatic than other tech firms and said, well, we can agree to these terms and we'll sort it out in the negotiations. I think that's something that actually a lot of principled individuals within the company just think won't happen, actually. The Trump White House will steamroller it.
Yeah, well, that's the point. That we keep having these pretty high-profile resignations. But what changes?
Unfortunately, not a lot. You know, the OpenAI has said that they will be trying to revisit this agreement that they have with the US government, having already signed it, by the way, and saying, well, actually, perhaps we don't have as much wiggle room as we hope, but we think that we can sort this out. The reality is anybody who's been following the news, anybody who's been understanding Donald Trump over the last few months and years and his actions knows that he will go back on these sorts of things as readily as he signs them. And so I'm not entirely convinced that actually if they do reach an agreement to say you can't use this militarily, that will always hold.
And just in brief, Anthropic checked out of it all, didn't want any part of it. Presumably, they've lost loads of money.
Yeah, around about a couple of $100 million with the US military contract in particular. But there are add-on wrinkles to this where companies that want to work with them but also want to work with the US government have to think carefully about this. Some have actually said they think this doesn't deal with anything beyond defence, so they are still good to do that. But certainly their reputation, their bottom line, has taken a hit.
Let's talk about the board of Nscale. Now, this is a British AI startup. And, well, it must be something with enormous potential because joining the board are Sheryl Sandberg and one Nick Clegg. Right, what has this company got?
Yeah, effectively, they are overseeing a large number of data centres that are going to be rolled out into the UK, building the data centre infrastructure. They've become the de facto go-to choice for both the UK government and also for US companies wanting to invest in the UK. So NVIDIA signed a big deal with them. Microsoft have also brokered an agreement, and effectively what this does is make them a massively valuable company. So they've raised another $2 billion announced this week. That values them just shy of $15 billion or so. That's really not bad for a UK company. And yeah, they now have pretty strong heavyweights joining their board. So Sheryl Sandberg, intimately involved in the founding of Meta, where then was Facebook, and of course Nick Clegg, who has also been involved in Facebook. I think those two hires are designed to try and ease some of the relations that'll be going on between the company and the government and building out this AI infrastructure for the future.
Right, okay. In what sense? They could just make contacts, they know people, pick up the phone, that sort of thing?
Yeah, they know how to walk the walk and talk the talk effectively. Both are very strong political characters. And yeah, we've seen a habit of this sort of thing where ex-politicians end up joining these tech companies, helping smooth that transition somewhat for them.
Interesting. Thank you very much. Chris Stoker-Walker, a tech journalist, joins us every Monday at around this time. It's good to see Nick Clegg getting another little bit of work.
Another little helping hand.
Yeah.
I'd feel better about the world of future tech if Chris Stoker-Walker was on the board of these companies. Wouldn't you?
I don't trust him. No, I do trust him. He's our go-to for all matters tech, isn't he?
Dreadful thing to say. A very quick one from Nick, whose cat Malcolm is the type who would look at her recently deceased body on the kitchen floor and think, well, that's just great. Who the hell is going to open the cat food now? Nick, I may have misgendered you there. You might be a he. I'm so sorry.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Well, we live in difficult times. It's 3 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. Still to come, advisers to a decaying regime mired in conflict. We'll talk to the historian Anthony Beaver about the key players in the war in the Middle East and his new book on Rasputin. We'll hear what the fighting will mean for energy prices in the UK and what you could do right now with our Money Matters man, Adam Shaw. Vassos returns with the sport too. And after 3:30, we talk books. That is so, so revolting with the time. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very, very sorry. Back away from your radio now, but not too far so you can't hear the latest news headlines with Stuart Willey. So sorry, Stuart.
Hey, thank you. Good afternoon. The Prime Minister has warned of the economic impact of the Iran crisis, saying the longer it goes on, the more severe the damage. Oil prices earlier climbed to $119 a barrel, their highest level since 2022. The Chancellor Rachel Reeves will update MPs this afternoon on the government's response after joining an emergency G7 meeting on the conflict earlier. But Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch says the government has reacted too slowly.
At the moment, what we're seeing is a lot of turbulence globally. We need a government that is quick to move and that can fix things when problems occur. We have a plan to drill oil and gas in the North Sea. Keir Starmer doesn't have a plan. He's just hoping that these problems will go away. If we want to sort the cost of living, we need to take proper measures that will help businesses and help families deal with rising energy costs.
Meanwhile, Downing Street has downplayed suggestions an aircraft carrier is being readied to protect British interests in the Middle East. NATO air defences in the Mediterranean have shot down a second ballistic missile in Turkish airspace that Ankara says was fired from Iran. And Abu Dhabi authorities say they responded to two incidents of debris falling following successful interceptions by air defence systems. At least five members of the Iranian women's football team are reported to have claimed asylum in Australia. It comes after a senior Iranian official branded them traitors after some refused to sing the national anthem before a match at an international tournament. Donald Trump is urging Australia's Prime Minister to grant asylum to the team, posting online that it would be a terrible humanitarian mistake to allow them to return home. In other news, the government says it's seeking a patriotic renewal of England's communities under its social cohesion plan. It includes measures to promote integration, tackle religious hatred, and clamp down on extremist influences in places such as charities and universities. But Ted Cantle, who authored a report on integration after race riots 25 years ago, told Times Radio providing English language teaching is just a start.
Once people learn English, they've got to be able to communicate with the people in the same community. And if they don't meet in the same school or in the same workplace or in the same community centre, then English language on its own is really not very helpful without some form of integration.
Scotland's First Minister has been praising emergency services after a huge blaze nearby closed Glasgow Central Station. John Swinney says the country's busiest station is unlikely to reopen tomorrow. He was speaking outside the scene of the fire.
This has been an incredibly serious incident right in the heart of the centre of Glasgow, and the only silver lining is that nobody has been injured in what is an enormous fire that has taken place. Every effort is being undertaken to make sure that we can open the station as quickly as it is safe to do so.
And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
I think we need to thank Stuart Willey for his ultimate professionalism.
He's very professional.
He's very, very professional, and well done for bringing us some very serious news in serious times in a suitably serious voice. No thanks to you, madam.
No, I know. I'm really sorry.
We talk books.
Ryan, never again. Okay. I can honestly say I'm extremely embarrassed. I'm so sorry. I was just saying to Fee, I'd forgotten where I was.
Oh, Lordy. I just have to deal with this every day, kids. Right. It's 2026. You're in a radio studio. We're on air.
Yes, I know. Yeah. I know. And we are both full of cold. So apologies from us both, but particularly me. Obviously, particularly me. Right. In the next hour or so, we have got our books with Laura Hackett. Looking forward to that. Money Matters with Adam Shaw, talking about energy prices today. And what else? Oh, sport with Vassos Alexander, talking about the trouble at the Old Firm game yesterday. But first, wide-scale Israeli airstrikes on the Iranian capital of Tehran began today after the regime selected a new supreme leader. Now, the choice of Ayatollah Khamenei's son, Mojtaba, has been described as unacceptable by Donald Trump. There's no sign of the fighting dying down, and oil prices are seeing their biggest spike in 6 years. So Keir Starmer said today that the longer the conflict goes on, the greater the chance of an economic impact on the UK.
We're looking cross-departmental within government, assessing the risks, monitoring, and talking to our international partners as well about what more we can do together to reduce the likely impact on people here and businesses here, of course. But it is important to acknowledge that that work is needed. Because people will sense, you will sense, I think, that the longer this goes on, the more likely the potential for an impact on our economy, impact into the lives and households of everybody and every business.
Well, that's Sir Keir Starmer. Well, Anthony Beaver, Sir Anthony Beaver, is a military historian and the author of books including Stalingrad, and his latest, Rasputin and the Downfall of the Romanovs, is out later this week on Thursday. Sir Anthony Beaver, good afternoon to you. Do you think Sir Keir Starmer, who's a sober and sort of relatively straight individual, is he getting the mood right?
Moods are very difficult to get right, obviously. But at the same time, considering the threat that we are facing, I don't think he is. I think it is much too, in a way, much too sort of casual almost. We are facing the worst and the biggest threat, I think, certainly since 1939, and probably perhaps even worse than that. And considering the state of our armed forces and the humiliation suffered, you know, during the course of the week with HMS Dragon unable to take off for the Mediterranean and so forth, we are absolutely failing in what we need to be doing at this very crucial moment.
What would you like him to have said?
I would like him to have said that there is an immediate uptick in defence spending because, I mean, here we are with anything up to a 30 billion shortage on defence money when the world is literally on the edge. I mean, I'm being rung up by journalists sort of saying, what is the definition of world war? How close are we? Now, we are in the grey zone of war at the moment. There's no doubt about it. The chances of a real war taking place within the next 2 or 3 years are generally estimated to be very high indeed. Why are we not actually doing something about that and allowing our armed forces to carry on in a totally hollowed out manner?
And the HMS Dragon saga, are you depressed by that? Is that simply an illustration of where we are?
It's one illustration across a whole range of where we are. The shortage of ammunition. I mean, how much ammunition has the army got, even if we were to suddenly find ourselves at war? The answer is that in many cases, many contracts have not yet even been signed, and there has not been sort of the switch towards a war economy, which is actually going to be needed.
I'm really interested in whether you think the British public are ready for that kind of realistic conversation about defence spending. I always think back to the election campaign back in 2024, and defence spending barely referred to during that period. The Prime Minister today has focused on, and I understand why, domestic issues, household bills. That's what most people seem to focus on.
Well, they are, but we're living in a, shall we say, in a slightly mad world, in the sense of certainly an unreal one, in this particular area. I mean, the way that in the sort of latest spring statements and budgets and so forth, the spending has all gone entirely on welfare rather than on the armed forces. But I mean, the first duty of any government is the defence of the country. And we're not seeing that, I'm afraid. It is not a proper conversation. And we had this mistake in the 1930s. The reason why there was this sort of a tremendous feeling of pacifism at that particular time was this basically a democratic confirmation bias. We could not believe that dictators were going to behave in the way that they were going to. And both the British and the French could not imagine that anybody would want to have another war after the horrors of the First World War. Well, I'm afraid we're still in that position today. We did not imagine that Putin was so keen on fighting another major war on the Eurasian landmass.
There are so many people in the mix here, notably, of course, the, shall we call him, mercurial President of the United States.
yes.
And I know you have concerns about him and about his mental state, but he is claiming already, in exchanges with our own Prime Minister, that the war is won. I mean, that is, it's palpable nonsense, isn't it?
Well, it is, and I'm afraid we are, or he rather is living in a totally unreal world, and this is what is very frightening indeed. He is just longing to declare victory and move on to something else. Maybe he wants another tick, so another 8 wars, which he's solved, and therefore will get a Nobel Peace Prize. But, I mean, one really does worry about his mental state when he gives a totally different reason for going to war in the Middle East to every single journalist he speaks to. So, you know, we are really powerless in a way, facing one of the most powerful, in fact, probably the most powerful leader in the world at the moment, who has very little clue of what he is really trying to do and has no idea how to get there. But this has actually brought the world into a war which we, I'm afraid, and I fear very much, are going to be dragged into.
Do you think there is some sort of voice of reason in the American administration? JD Vance seems to have just disappeared a little bit.
You're quite right to point that out. I think it's very significant that he has disappeared. J.D. Vance is certainly one of the MAGA establishment who are totally against foreign wars in this particular way. And yet here they are. They have to keep quiet when their boss basically seems to be wanting to start another war or another conflict almost every other day. So, yes, we are in a very, very alarming position.
But couldn't he, you know, come out and actually challenge Trump's thinking? Or is that simply not possible?
I don't think it's possible. He is such a narcissist and such a so self-centred in his view of everything that he is the sort of genius. He knows exactly what is right. I don't think anybody even around him, and this is actually the worrying thing, nobody can bear to speak truth unto power in the White House administration.
And you said that you fear that we are going to be dragged into it. What form might that take?
We already can see which form it is. I mean, the initial state will be that obviously use of our bases, and it's very hard, particularly in the cases of Diego Garcia and the sovereign bases in Cyprus, and even bases here, that they will be used by the Americans, in which case, to a certain degree, that will drag us in automatically because we will be seen as part of a coalition fighting Iran at this particular moment. So I don't see how we can avoid it as things are going at the moment. And the idea of actually sort of cutting off and refusing all aid will certainly provoke an explosion in Washington and no doubt tariffs or whatever he will attempt. But not that the Supreme Court might allow him to do that, but certainly of getting some sort of revenge for being frustrated in this way.
The fact that Donald Trump has said he's really not keen on the new Supreme Leader, in a way, it's a good illustration of his naivety that he honestly thought that the people who run Iran might agree to appoint somebody, I don't know, the Iranian equivalent of Sered Davy or somebody. I mean, it was just unthinkable, wasn't it?
Well, it is. And as I say, it is a refusal to face reality and to imagine that they would actually follow his advice. And he says that he wanted to choose the next leader. I'm afraid this does slightly emphasise that not only is he out of touch with reality. I mean, I am certainly not alone in suggesting that he is already starting to show signs of dementia. And I think that this is deeply, deeply worrying.
Well, I certainly, we've on this programme featured various members of the wider Trump family who believe exactly that. I think it was Fred Trump who told us that he thought, because dementia is in the family, the Trump family, I think mm-hmm. Fred Trump Sr. had it, didn't he?
He did indeed, yes.
But again, I mean, he may well, and of course Joe Biden had a cognitive decline of his own. Why do these, well, it's not just the USA, but why this clinging to these elderly men as leaders? It is, it's just plain dangerous, isn't it?
Well, it is, and we've certainly had it in this country. I mean, the whole question with Churchill and refusing to hand over to Anthony Eden back in the 1950s. So we're not entirely exempt from it. Fortunately, though, I don't think that our political system has really sort of allowed that form of clinging on too long. But certainly in the United States, and above all when you've got such a divisive atmosphere and mood in the whole country, people are in positions of power and are refusing quite often, you know, to let go out of sheer desperation. So I think that is, again, deeply worrying.
Your next book, it comes out on Thursday, is about Rasputin. Yes. I don't know quite how we shoehorn a mood change and start talking about Rasputin, but are there links between the power that he had over the Romanovs and, I don't know, any modern day comparisons you can think of?
Well, no. I mean, in fact, he was unique. I think, as many people said at the time, it was unthinkable that somebody who was basically a Siberian semi-literate peasant could have such influence and such power. And what's fascinating, of course, is this is a complete reversal of the great man theory of history, that somebody who basically comes from nowhere can actually, without backing, without his own sort of support, can have such a devastating effect. And not just from the point of view of his influence over the imperial family, but the way that rumour and fear of the corruption which surrounded him as a result created a form of fake news which then contributed entirely to the Russian Revolution. As Kerensky, who was the leader of the provisional government, said later, you know, without Rasputin there would have been no Lenin.
Gosh, it sounds an incredibly interesting book. I hope to end on a note of optimism about our current circumstances, Sir Anthony. Can you find anything optimistic to tell us?
I would love to. Maybe we will suddenly see sort of sanity returning. But at the moment, I'm afraid I see very little in that particular way.
Sir Anthony Beaver, thank you very much indeed. His new book is Rasputin and the Downfall of the Romanovs, out later on this week.
Well, we are going to try and entertain you and take your minds and your ears elsewhere after 3:30. We'll consider some new books and some old books with the fabulous Laura Hackett. And Adam Shaw is going to tell you what you could do with your money in order to keep it as safe as possible at the moment. So both of those things in about 20 minutes' time. Vassos Alexander is here with the sport in a couple of moments. The Celtic Rangers game went off in all the wrong ways at Ibrox this weekend. That's what we'll talk about next. You're with Jane and Fionn Times Radio, with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Early breakfast with Rosie Wright on Times Radio. Start the morning bright and early with me, Rosie Wright, to discover the day. I'll have a first look at the news.
We've got far more patients needing help and far fewer GPs to deliver it.
The business headlines.
We've seen signs that we could actually avoid a recession.
Sports and, of course, politics too.
The government really are coming under criticism, particularly from the House of Lords, that they didn't put a much more binding agreement in place.
Early breakfast with Rosie Wright.
Tomorrow morning from 5 on Times Radio.
The all-new Velvetizer by Hotel Chocolat. Obsessively engineered for the ultimate drinking chocolate. Hot and now cold. You don't need to know how it melds real chocolate or how its custom whisk and inner pod ridges create the vortex effect. You don't need to understand how we got there. And that's exactly the point. We've obsessed over every detail so you can simply taste why it matters. The all-new Velvetizer by Hotel Chocolat.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
It's 20 minutes past three. Clashes between Celtic and Rangers fans yesterday have been described in the Times as the worst since the infamous riot in 1980. Hundreds of supporters of both teams flooded the pitch at Ibrox after Celtic won on penalties. The rival groups threw bottles, pyrotechnics at each other, police struggling to keep them apart. Let's talk to Vassos Alexander about this. I mean, this was just grotesque, wasn't it? I mean, there were people, who pulled up masks and put balaclavas on. And, I mean, it just looked like they were looking for trouble right from the get-go.
Yeah, Vassos. It felt like, the fact that they came onto the pitch wearing masks, that felt totally premeditated. Let me just, for those who haven't seen it, sort of outline what happened. So Celtic win the Scottish Cup tie, really boring match on the pitch, on penalties. Some of their fans, and they were given the full allocation, full 7,500 tickets they were given for the first time since 2018, in consultation with both clubs, in consultation with the police. They didn't think this would go off. Some of them in jubilation came onto the pitch. Rangers fans initially tried to react but were held back, but then more Celtic fans come on the pitch and they're goading and they're celebrating and whooping, and then the Rangers fans just couldn't resist and they broke through the barriers, and for a moment it looked like we'd have the truly appalling spectacle of the two rival fans clashing on the pitch. Mercifully, that was avoided. But yes, flagpoles were thrown, at least one flare was thrown, bottles were thrown. And then, the police, like one member of the Celtic backroom team was wrestled to the floor and attacked and is apparently okay. But it was just a horrible thing to see, in 2026. You mentioned the match in 1980. And this has been such a season of celebration for Scottish football. Qualifying for the World Cup, that amazing playoff win against Denmark. This is, this is Scottish football. Let's and what a weekend for Scottish sport after the rugby as well. But then, unfortunately, I come into the studio and obviously this is what we have to discuss. Yeah.
But these two teams, they carry with them, some of their fans carry with them something else, don't they, Vassos, which is actually just completely outside football.
It is. I mean, Martin O'Neill, who has been around this fixture for decades, and he is the current interim Celtic manager, he said, my heart is beating in a way a 74-year-old's heart should not be beating. He was asked about the bitterness between the two sets of fans. He says, I don't know whether it's grown, but it hasn't lessened in any way. If any of us ever come down to this earth in 500 years, it'll be exactly the same. Yes, this does go.
Is it worth reminding people what it's about? I mean, it's just crazy.
It's sectarian. It's Catholic and Protestant. It's
anything but football.
It is anything but football. Watching the fans come on the pitch with the sort of Spider-Man masks they looked like, it felt like they came tooled up. I was once cycling in London and a taxi cut up a cyclist in front of me, and that cyclist had a chain in his pocket which he used to whack the taxi with. But if you're leaving the house with that sort of intention, and that's what it felt like yesterday, that some of the fans were leaving the house with these masks with the intention of causing trouble.
I suppose just because there's so much trouble in the world right now, there's something utterly ludicrous about this.
About a football match being marred in this way.
It's so parochial, for Pete's sake. Catholics and Protestants having grow up.
Yes.
No, honestly, yes. It's tragic.
But as you mentioned, Vassos, there is so much awareness of what can happen between some of the fans of these two teams. The police are often involved in making sure that trouble doesn't flare up, and they did eventually manage the situation at Ibrox. But what more could they possibly do? I mean, they've got their intel, they've got their precautions, but this still happens.
Yeah, so they're all investigating. Everybody's investigating. Neither club has issued a statement at the moment. The SFA have, the Scottish Football Association have said they condemn the fact that supporters from both sides entered the pitch. They will look at whether Rangers stewarding was adequate, because this was a Rangers home game, and we expect another statement from Scottish police at some point later this afternoon. I mean, what will happen to these ticket allocations for future Old Firm games? Will they? For a long time there were no away fans allowed in these matches, and then we thought we'd grown up, and then this happens.
I mean, there'll be loads and loads of CCTV and surveillance, so I suppose you could hope that it's easier to find out exactly who the troublemakers are. But as you say, they came on the pitch with the masks on, hoods right up. Difficult,
but you know, you never know. I mean, football stadiums are pretty good for CCTV, and if anyone is suspected of, I don't know, a racist chant or something like that, it's pretty easy to identify that person via CCTV. So maybe the CCTV can get the people in the stands before they put the masks on and the hoods up. You never know. We weren't seeing a lot of arrests on the pitch yesterday, but I think the police had their work cut out, yeah. You know, and then does that escalate the situation? You know, I'm not a policing expert, but it felt like they handled it as well as they could, yeah, on the day.
Andy says the chain was probably to secure his bike.
It didn't feel like that, Andy. I was there.
Right. Shall we talk about something a little bit more positive in the weekend for Scottish sport fans?
Yes. Yeah. Wow. What a match. Scotland 50, France 40. Do you remember the old teletext football results? And if a team scored 7, they would put it in letters as well, SEVEN, because, you know, they didn't quite believe that anyone could score 7. That's what that rugby match feels like. Scotland 50, brackets, FIFTY, France, the Grand Slam nailed on team, 40. I mean, what a game of rugby. What a fantastic turnaround for Scotland, who lost to Italy in their first match in Rome, and everyone was like, oh, you know, Scotland, they're a laughing stock again, you never know what you're going to get with them. And Gregor Townsend, the coach, was basically, he was fearing for his job ahead of the England match, which came next at Murrayfield. And now Scotland could win the title. Amazing.
Brilliant.
What about England?
I know. There was a brilliant little piece in the Times this morning which I read. I think Stuart Barnes wrote it. Let me just read you this. It will be the rugby photograph to cap the international career of Federico Ruzza, the 31-year-old Italian lock forward rising high in splendid isolation to catch the throw that would seal Italy's historic first victory against England. It shouldn't be an impossible shot to take because there's not an Englishman to be seen taking the aerial route. There were 10 seconds remaining and England did not compete against Italy's 5-man line out, even though the result was done and dusted if Italy could secure the set piece. He says England are overcoached to oblivion. So that even when this is DEFCON 1, you're going to lose to Italy for the first time in 32 matches, don't just play the defence. You have to win this line-out, so contest the line-out. But they're so sort of, you know, their brains are so frazzled by all this coaching and all this sort of defensive rugby that they're playing that they didn't even contest the line-out. And that, I'm afraid, especially having read that, is my overriding memory of the match.
Breathe, Vassos, breathe.
I know. I was so looking forward to the Six Nations as an England fan. 12 wins in a row for England. I thought, Grand Slam. The Grand Slam decider in France. My goodness me, England, for the first time, look likely to end a Six Nations campaign with a solitary win.
Well, I mean, it makes everybody else laugh, doesn't it?
It does, exactly.
Because they're not,
yeah,
exactly the most popular, are they, with everybody else? So I would imagine that, other supporters of other nations are having a right old chuckle.
Well, you know, and you're welcome.
Yes. Okay. Hilary has quite a few contributions, and she's in Glasgow, and she's sick of Glasgow football. These sectarian divisions in Glasgow are perpetuated by us still having separate Catholic, non-denominational primary schools and high schools. So while some go to non-religious school, some children do go to Catholic schools. I think it just exacerbates the problem later in life. But yes, I agree. Grow up. Mm. And she's put a couple more messages in there too. But, I mean, it does go back to that kind of sectarianism and those problems between two religions. But I think a lot of people are saying it's just an excuse. If you're a thug and you want to turn out as a thug, you'll find a place to go and be a thug.
Yes, I guess so. But there is something about the old firm game that I've never fully understood, but it goes beyond football, and it seems like it's embedded in the culture in Glasgow, whereas, you know, there are Newcastle and Sunderland, Tottenham and Arsenal, Aston Villa and Birmingham City, you know, Ipswich and Norwich.
Keep going.
They don't like each other.
No.
There's a bit of a rivalry, but it's encompassed in the whole kind of football thing. This goes way beyond the football thing.
Yeah, I've just never understood faith schools, but that might be something that's a little bit outside of the skill set of our sports segment. Not you, but just our sports segment. We'll save that one for another time. Vassos, thank you very much.
Yeah,
sorry, am I cutting you off in your prime?
No, Ali says, I don't think it is Catholic Protestant anymore. It's just young thugs looking for trouble. A lot of them drink in the same bars and save it all for the games. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can believe that, actually.
Well, I mean, the sale of alcohol in Scottish stadiums was forbidden after that 1980 riot at Hampden Park after the cup final when the fans did clash on the pitch. And ever since then, you can't... Well, I think in some of the hospitality areas you can, but generally you can't buy alcohol at grounds.
Thank you very much, Vassos. Much more, of course, on thetimes.com. All the latest sports news right there.
And after the very latest headlines, we're going to open the doors of our literary salon with The Times' Laura Hackett. Let's get those headlines first with Stuart Willie.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The AA is suggesting drivers could cut down on non-essential journeys as oil prices soar because of the conflict in the Middle East. Rachel Reeves will update MPs this afternoon on the government's economic response to the war. Earlier, the Chancellor attended a meeting where G7 finance ministers discussed the crisis. They're reported to have delayed a decision on the release of emergency reserves. Elsewhere, the King and Queen have been heckled as they arrive for a Commonwealth Day service at Westminster Abbey. It's Charles and Camilla's first significant public appearance since the arrest of the former Prince Andrew. Glasgow Central Station's expected to stay shut tomorrow after a fire that destroyed much of a 19th century building next to it. First Minister John Swinney has promised financial support to the city's council. Cathy Adams from The Times Travel Desk says the closure is causing massive chaos.
Glasgow is Scotland's busiest rail station. About 80,000 people go through it every single day. So, you know, its impact is being felt much more widely. If you are trying to get around Scotland, if you do have travel plans to kind of go up to Scotland from down south, then maybe do rethink them.
And a 58-year-old man living in the UK has been charged with crimes against humanity and torture in Syria. It's linked to the 2011 uprising. Don't forget, you can set the Times Radio news briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
Hello, Greg James here.
And I'm Seema Pankania.
And we're the hosts of the Tesco Kitchen.
Every week, Greg and I invite a culinary powerhouse into the kitchen to cook a recipe that really means something to them.
Hold on to your hairnets, because this week we're joined by chef, musician and host of Big Zoo's Big Eats. You might have guessed it. It's Big Zoo.
Zoo is taking us on a trip down memory lane and showing us how to cook the lasagna that changed his life forever.
It's live right now on YouTube, so get involved.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens. There's over 80 stunning styles to choose from and great offers too, including the Spend and Save with up to 50% off kitchen units. Terms and minimum spend apply. Find out more at wickes.co.uk.
Good afternoon. Well, that's more like it.
Yes, I'm trying to be, after what happened before 3 o'clock, I'm just desperately trying to regather myself and reclaim just some pride.
Yeah, I think we just need to hear it one last time.
One last
time. We talk books. That is so, so revolting.
I haven't got any excuse. I just didn't realise my colleague was broadcasting when I blew my nose.
Dear me, Jane.
Anyway, yeah. Laura Hackett is here. You'll be glad to know if you're remotely interested. We've both had rather nasty colds. I'm getting over mine-ish. But Fee, you've had it quite bad, haven't you?
I've had it quite bad, but I'm trying to keep it to myself.
No, well, you've done reasonably well. It's Literary Salon time. Laura Hackett is Deputy Literary Editor of The Times and Sunday Times. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you. It seems like a bit of a den of lines.
No,
I've
you'll be
into
all right.
Yeah,
no,
infection-wise.
It really is. I tell you what, I've got antibacterial hand wipes here.
Right.
You can take them with you when you go, and you just breathe in quite a shallow way. You should be absolutely fine.
Right, yes.
Yeah, just don't take too much in. I mean, do you have anything planned later in the week?
Not anymore.
Don't start a long book, love. Right, Laura Hackett is here to talk about some of the best books around right now. Let's start with Tara Menon. This is coming on the 17th of March. It's called Underwater. What is this about?
It is about, and this is a hard sell, the 2004 Boxing Day tsunami.
Okay.
Which is actually the first global event I remember happening as a child. I remember watching it it was obviously Boxing Day, watching it on the TV all day. But basically, this is a story about, it's told from the perspective of Marissa, who is a young woman who survived the Boxing Day tsunami. She was living in Thailand with her father, who was a sort of marine biologist. She survived it. Her best friend, Ariel, did not. And now she is basically carrying all of the trauma, the memories and the grief of that. And she's now living in New York in 2012, as Hurricane Sandy is about to hit.
Right.
So it's about these two global destructive events. She's living through both of them. The memories of the two are colliding. And what I think it does really well is it basically describes the 2 days before the tsunami. And of course, we as the reader know what's going to happen, but young Marissa doesn't. And it's sort of that build up, and especially the morning of, because there were no real signs that anything was going to happen. It was this beautiful day, crystal clear waters. And I think what Tara Menon does really well is that suspense of knowing it's about to happen.
Yes, and that really does make the readers, actually, it's got me slightly shivery just thinking about it.
Yes, there's sort of these lines about a dog that starts running around in circles chasing its tail. All the birds disappear. So the animals know that something's going on, but the humans don't.
Now, who is Tara Menon?
She is a Harvard professor. She was born in India but grew up in Singapore. So she was a teenager in Singapore when the tsunami happened. And she said that almost every year her family would go to Thailand for a holiday over the Christmas period, and that year, for whatever reason, they didn't. So I think it's sort of fueled by this sense of what if? What if I'd been there? What if, by chance, my family hadn't decided not to go?
Right, okay. I mean, what do you think on the whole about writers claiming terrible events from history and mining them for creative purposes? I mean, I appreciate this author does have a sort of a family link, but is it all right?
Well,
I know it's been done by hundreds of writers.
For me, the problem isn't necessarily the ethics of it. It's more, how do you actually describe something which is so indescribably horrible if you weren't there? Yeah. And I think, you know, I was saying what she does very well is the suspense. What felt to me slightly less powerful was her description, which obviously has to come, of being caught up in the tsunami itself. And you sort of were aware that she was stretching her descriptive powers a little bit, which is natural because she wasn't there and didn't experience it. But you sort of are aware that it's a novel and it's trying to do it. And it brings you out a little bit from, I think, the kind of immersion that you get in the earlier parts of the novel.
So is it a thriller? What is it exactly?
It's a literary novel. It's just a sort of, it's fiction. It's all from Marissa's perspective. So a lot of it is about the impact of that sort of a trauma, how you walk around. I mean, literally, she's got the scars to show it, but also how you go back into society and make friends with people who haven't lived through something like that.
Yes, I imagine that must be absolutely impossible, because where do you start with people? What's your small talk game?
Yeah, exactly. And what I found really interesting was that the character in the book says that when they all went back to school after the tsunami, that the classes were split between people who had been in the wave and people who had somehow avoided it, and that they couldn't really connect with each other anymore. And I found that sort of exploration of the psychological element really interesting, but I find the actual description of the tsunami, it just wasn't quite there.
Okay, but the rest of it impressed you.
Yes.
And it's out in a couple of weeks. Oh, 17th of March is next week, isn't it?
Yeah.
Underwater by Tara Menon. Now, An Arrow in Flight by Mary Lavin came out last week. What's this about?
So Mary Lavin was an Irish writer. She mainly wrote short stories. Lots of them were published in The New Yorker. But after she died in 1996, she was slightly forgotten about. I mean, I hadn't heard of her, and I try to read a lot of Irish writing. And this is a collection of her short stories brought together. And I just thought they were absolutely wonderful. I mean, sometimes I struggle with short stories because you've got to sort of immerse yourself myself in one and then the other and then the other. But with this, it just felt really effortless. What she does really well is looking at, well, first of all, families and how they operate, but also especially being a widow, because she was widowed at the age of 42 with three young children. And lots of her characters in the story are widows. And what's great is that they aren't all just sort of victims. They respond to the grief in many different ways. Some of them become cruel towards other people, or like they want to own the grief for themselves. Others get frustrated when people say, oh, I remember this about your husband, and they think, well, I'd forgotten him for a minute and now you've brought it back into my mind. Right. And she writes these really powerful characters and she never judges them, I feel. And I just think she's a really wonderful writer who deserves to be remembered and read.
Yeah. Do you like short stories?
Yes, sometimes. It depends where my head is, because sometimes all I can take is a short story. I think I read a lot for work. I mean, I know that you read more, Laura, so I feel bad now I've said that. But sometimes I just can't get my head around a great big huge novel. So I've absolutely loved short stories. I mean, the ultimate ones are Saki, aren't they? Which I think my sister gave me a compendium when I was in my early 20s, and I couldn't believe how beautiful, vicious, brutal, fantastic they were. So maybe I've always had a bit of a soft spot.
Yeah, I don't really like them, if I'm honest. I just feel a bit shortchanged. And if I enjoy characters, I resent their disappearance and I can't be bothered investing in other ones.
I think it can often feel quite tiring,
yeah,
because it takes a while to figure out, okay, where are we? Who are these people and what's going on? And then it sometimes feels as soon as you've figured it out, the story's over and you've got to do it again. But with these, I just didn't really get that. I felt kind of immediately immersed in whatever world and character they were. And I quite liked that you got this little glimpse and then you could leave them in their lives.
To get on with things. Let's hope they're all right. The next one we're going to discuss is Hooked by Asako Yuzuki. Now, this is about a messy housewife blogger.
It is. So this is the follow-up to Butter. You might remember from a few years ago.
A book I picked up and gave to one of my daughters but didn't read.
That's fair enough. The jacket was kind of everywhere. You couldn't move for seeing people. It was this yellow jacket with an upside-down cow. I actually really liked it. It was quite fun. It was a sort of feminist crime novel, but it had a real foodie twist to it. And right. I thought it was fun. So I was really looking forward to Hooked. It didn't quite live up to it for me.
Okay.
So this is about two women. Eriko, who's this single woman in her 30s, she works for a seals company in Tokyo and primarily she works on fish imports, which seems like that won't be significant, is weirdly significant to the plot. Mm-hmm. She becomes obsessed with this woman, Shoko, who runs a blog about the fact that she's a housewife, but not one of these kind of perfect Instagram housewives who bake their own bread every day. She's a bit of a slob. She doesn't like doing the housework. I know. But Erica really likes how sort of relatable she is and ends up bumping into her by chance and then becoming completely obsessed with her, following her everywhere, at one point blackmailing her into being her friend. And they're always comparing each other to this fish called the Nile perch, which is an invasive fish species. And there's weirdly a lot about the Nile perch, and I find myself not that interested in the Nile perch.
I feel for you a bit there. I'm not sure it would be a huge draw for many.
No. So yeah, to me, this felt like there were some good ideas, but it just didn't come together. And all of the characters are a bit annoying, and I just didn't find myself rooting for any of them. And it was a bit of a slog.
A bit 6 out of 10 from you there, Laura.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, okay, but she is terribly popular. And no doubt the cover, because the cover of, it was Butter, wasn't it?
Yes.
Was brilliant.
Yeah.
Now, if they've got a good cover for this.
They do have a really good cover.
What does it look like?
It's a fish tin. It's a tin of fish.
Oh, I've seen it.
But there are shiny bits. Yeah, right. It looks really good.
Super clever.
Is the Nile perch an edible fish?
Oh, good question.
It is.
Yes.
That's why they are trying to import it. But the problem is, it's so aggressive as a fish species that no matter where you put it, it kills off all the other fish and then starts eating each other. Mm. And it's that metaphor of a fish that can't be around other fish that sums up this story, which is all about how difficult female friendship is.
Do you know what? Our attempt to lighten the national mood has absolutely failed.
You just don't often see perch on a menu, do you?
You don't. But, well, I'm really getting to the weeds with this, now. But the whole point of the Nile perch is it's a very bland-tasting fish. So that if you were to go somewhere in Japan and it just says white fish and doesn't explain what type it is, it's probably Nile perch. Or so I learned from the book, which is a novel, so I could be telling you lies.
Okay, yeah. Interesting. Actually, no, I am interested by that.
Yeah, you are. Laura is not really recommending that. It's the follow-up to Butter is Hooked by Asako Yuzuki. Have you had your copy yet of Town Like Alice by Neville Shute?
I have. Now, it's very attractive. It's a
lovely little edition. We found this fantastic new tiny edition of A Town Like Alice. This is the book we are reading for the Off Air with Jane and Fee book club podcast, which we'll record either next week or the week after that. I had not read a Neville Shute for quite some time, and I don't know really what I'm halfway through, and I'm finding it a bit of a struggle. Sorry about that. I thought I would enjoy it, but I don't know.
Is it the first time you've read the book?
Yes. Yeah, it will be, yeah. I mean, I've been stuck on Hooked, not feeling very hooked to it for the past week, but I was looking forward to this as a breath of fresh air, but maybe not.
I think it'll be fascinating to hear your thoughts as a first-time reader, because reason why we chose it in the podcast was because we wanted to do a reread of a book that probably most of us encountered in our 20s. And I think this is a superb example of a book that you might have two completely different opinions about at different times in your life. But I think it's very readable, and I think he writes brilliantly. The bumps in the road are that he doesn't attempt in any way to challenge the misogyny and the racism of his time. So it's quite ouchy as you read it, but that in and of itself, Jane, is a talking point in the salon.
And that just gives you a glimpse into the wonderful world of Off Air with Jane and Fee. We have a sort of rambly edition Monday to Thursday, but every now and again we'll just pop out a book club one and we all get together and often reread an old classic like A Town Like Alice, or a book that maybe was popular but faded a bit after its publication. So we love your ideas on everything. What were you about to say? We should mention what's happening today as well, shouldn't we?
What is happening today?
It's the YouTube thing.
Oh my goodness, yes, we should have mentioned that a little bit sooner, shouldn't we?
We've
got our own YouTube channel. Jane and Fee are up on the YouTube. There's new branding, new everything, and there's a visual edition of the podcast, isn't there?
Yes, it's on YouTube. You've got to search Off Air with Jane and Fee and you should be able to get today. Although we're both, as you can hear, full of cold, and we blew our noses quite a lot during that as well. But anyway, never mind.
It's real. Keeping it real.
Oh, it's so real. We're so authentic. Anyway, that's out there now on the YouTube. Is that slick?
It is very, very slick. Andy has sent us a picture. He is with a fisherman and they've caught a Nile perch. Will you look at the size of that?
It's huge.
That is bigger than Jane. It's bigger than Laura. It's bigger than me. That is an obscene amount of fish. Right.
Quite a few portions there, I think.
A lot of portions.
Right. Laura, thank you. You've served your time. You've done enough. I hope you haven't caught anything. Deputy Literary Editor of The Times and Sunday Times, Laura Hackett. Thank you for bearing with. We appreciate it.
Coming up, oil and gas prices are spiking. What does that mean for your energy bills? Adam Shaw is the man with all the answers. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
It's the pinnacle event of the jump racing calendar, the Cheltenham Festival. And from the excitement of Champion Day all the way to the unforgettable drama of Gold Cup Day, Times Radio will keep you up to date with all the action and results as they happen. Cheltenham Festival updates throughout the festival on Times Radio with Ladbrokes. We bring daily free bets for Cheltenham. That's Laddisfaction. 18 plus gambleaware.org.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Chase is the digital bank that gives you 1% cash back on groceries.
So can I get cash back on cake mix?
Indeed.
And icing?
Yep.
And sprinkles?
Sure.
And candles?
Yeah, and you can turn all that cash back into a nice birthday treat.
How do you know it's my birthday?
Just a hunch. Get 1% cash back on groceries, fuel and everyday transport when you spend with Chase. Search Chase Bank. 18 plus UK residents. 1% cash back on this debit card spending for your first year. Maximum £15 per month. Eligibility and exceptions apply. May be changed or withdrawn.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
We're just discussing cold remedies here. Gather round, everybody.
Oh dear, share prices have tumbled around the world as oil prices have surged past $100 a barrel. G7 finance ministers will be meeting today to discuss a possible release of petroleum from reserves coordinated by the International Energy Agency in order to try and bring some order to the markets and avoid what could turn into a global recession. Wholesale gas prices doubled in the past week or so, a jump that could lead to a sharp rise in household bills when Ofgem comes to refresh its price cap. Well, it's all just incredibly worrying. Our money doctor, Adam Shaw, is here. Adam, shall we start with domestic gas? What's happening to the price of that? And are we in a worse off position than other countries of a similar size because we haven't got a gas reserve big enough?
So there are two separate issues going on there. I think you're referring to security of supply, actually getting gas. Now, there had been some reports that we'd had, I think 2 days was the headline. The government came out very strongly and said that is not the case because we've got gas coming in. I think the answer to that was we have 2 days of stock, but gas is coming in, so we're not going to run out in 2 days' time. So for the moment, security of supply doesn't look problematic. But this is a fast-moving situation. Who knows? The other issue is price. The price is determined on the global market. So, what we do really makes very little difference to the price, I'm afraid. It is what happens on the global market. And that has gone berserk. I mean, it has seen increases. I think last time I looked, 50% up in the course of a couple of days. That's just off the charts. I think what's interesting, perhaps worrying, is what happens in the long term. And we've got to look. It's difficult to talk about, I suppose it sounds crass to talk about your own gas price when families are dying in the Middle East. But it's also naive to think that oil and gas is not part of this story. If the US wins the war in Iran, having effectively sort of got control of Venezuela, the US will control a third of the world's gas and oil, output, but its supply, its sort of reserves. That's interesting. That is interesting what it does with that, what other countries like China may feel about that strategic replacement. So this is a very big issue. For us, it boils down to what happens to our gas and oil prices, if this lasts much longer, it will go very much higher.
So where does the price cap fit into all of that?
Well, because last time we had a gas problem, the government stepped in and went, people have got to be able to afford to heat their homes. They instituted a price cap, which is run by Ofgem, the industry regulator, and every 3 months it reviews the price on the wholesale markets and then tells the energy companies, this is the maximum unit price you can charge for a unit of gas or electricity. The new one will come in April. It will fall. Bizarrely, you will see all this talk about gas prices rising, and then what will happen in the short term? Your gas price will fall. That's because it was based on what happened in the past. Plus the fact, what's happening is that the government has taken off some of the regulatory requirements, so you will, some of that will also be taken off your bill. So there'll be a short-term fall. I think the thing to look out for now is what happens in the long term and how risk-averse you are and how much you can afford a price rise, because there are deals out there now, fixed price deals for a year, which look appealing. I have to say, I was on the phone this morning trying to examine those. They look very good to me, and it's something I think I will move to. I'm on a fixed price. I think I will renew that fixed price as soon as I can, because that buys me security. One thing to say about fixed price deals is that they are not affected by the price cap. So the price cap is affected by the variable rate, but the fixed price deals are so good at the moment, it's worth looking out for them.
And are most people who are on a fixed price deal tied into it for a year?
Yes, for at least a year. And the other thing to think about that, I think the one I was looking at this morning had a really hefty exit charge. So if you suddenly decide, I don't want that fixed price deal, the one I was looking at was a £75 charge to get out of it. So it's something you've got to consider, and it's not just about the price. Although I think the prices are really good, I think it's more to do with, do you just want to not worry about it and go, if it rose by 30%, could I not afford to heat my home? In which case, you should start looking at these and go, it may not be the best deal, but on the other hand, I know I can afford it for the next 12 months. And that's not a small thing to say.
We've had a lot of text messages this afternoon about heating oil and some people facing some enormous rises suddenly in their bills. And Cole says, why isn't there a price cap on heating oil?
I mean, it's a political question, I suppose, because everyone, or not everyone, but I suppose the vast majority of people have gas central heating. Not those who are using oil as their source are mainly off-grid, so there's not as many people.
Well, we were told, was the WhatsApp said 1.7 million homes?
No, I mean, it's a lot of people. It's not the majority.
No.
But I suppose politicians feel, well, there isn't the political push, but I think if we're seeing prices rise like this, that might start to happen. And I think there's a similar thing going on here, even though there isn't a price cap on oil. Actually, if you've got a large oil reserve in your home because you're off-grid, you're somewhere a little more remote than others, now might be a time to fill up. I mean, to be honest, last week would have been a very good time to fill up. Now the prices are already very strong and one might hope that they come down. It really depends what happens in the Strait of Hormuz.
The other thing that people are worried about are mortgages, obviously, and I don't know how much we can prepare for what might be around the corner there, but certainly the interest rate coming down, as it was predicted to do, hopefully, maybe even a couple of times this year. I mean, that's just off the table now.
Well,
isn't it
is so volatile, it's difficult to tell, but you're quite right. I think this points to why this is such a bigger story than just what happens to your gas price, because if oil price is rising, we have an economy, for good or evil, that is based on oil. Everything you make sort of has an oil input into it. So when oil prices go up like this, it pushes up inflation of everything because all the companies' costs go up. If inflation is going to go up, the Bank of England is less likely to reduce interest rates, and it could push us towards a sort of recessionary environment. So that's very worrying indeed, and that would mean if that happened, it would mean that your mortgage rates are going to go up. So another thing you might, if you're looking at that, there's also something to consider, fixed rates. And stock markets are falling, you know, they're tumbling as a result of this. The only thing I'd say about this, especially when we're in a newsroom, you get obsessed with this. If you look over months, over a year, these things tend to settle down. And if you just look, if we take stock markets, for instance, which had a really bad week, still over the year, the London stock market's done really well. I mean, it's done a stellar performance, even given what's happened in the past week. So although I think we have to be cautious, aware and take action, one also shouldn't overreact, to set it in context of actually of a longer period.
Okay. Does it make any difference when President Trump gives his timelines on things? You know, this will be over in 5 to 6 weeks. This is weeks, not months.
I suppose it depends how much you believe that and whether you think he is master of that fate. I think the worry about President Trump and US policy at the moment is they've started something they're not fully in control of, might be the concern. And are they able to draw back? Because this is no longer such a restricted battle. This has had large implications all over the world, which they may not be able to control. And this is the lesson of history. You start these things, you may not be able to end them. And that is the terrible, worrying thing, if you want a pessimistic view, is that he may not be able to.
Right. Well, I don't think that we've really ended on a high
sorry.
But realism is important when we're talking about all of these things.
Yeah, it is. But look, I also said set it in context. Over the long term, the stock market still has done well. This may be something of a blip. You've got security in the price cap, energy price cap, so you're safe for the next 2 or 3 months if you're on the price cap. But it does mean to be looking out for stuff. Do look around for deals. Make sure you're looking around at least for the price cap.
Thank you very much, Adam.
I wonder whether we could just cheer people up by playing that clip of me blowing my nose again at 3 o'clock.
We talk books. That is so
revolting. Well, I'm sorry. I'm still sorry. Thank you, Ryan. And just worth remembering, we did have a guest from the Cats Protection League a little earlier in the show explaining that our cats really do love us, contrary to Hungarian research.
Yeah, but even he was a little bit on the fence, as cats often are.
Mine isn't. He's asleep on the sofa. Right, OK, thank you for bearing with. One of us in some human form will be back tomorrow.
Well, let's hope so. We'd like to thank our producer, Hannah Quinn, and our tech operator, Ryan Boyd. And John Peanut is next. We talk books.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Peanut. This is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. The Prime Minister has warned of the economic impact of the Iran crisis, saying the longer it goes on, the more severe the damage. At least five members of the Iranian women's football team are reported to have claimed asylum in Australia. And coming up, the Chancellor's statement on the state of the economy after the crisis in the Middle East, and General Sir Simon Mayle, former Deputy Chief of the Defence Staff and a Middle East advisor to the government, will be joining us with his thoughts on the war in Iran. And trust me, those thoughts are strong.
This is Times Radio.
For now, the news with Stuart Woody.
John, thank you. Good afternoon. France's president says he's deploying unprecedented naval force to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Oil prices earlier surged above $119 a barrel as producers cut production over worries of a prolonged closure of the waterway. But Emmanuel Macron says the mission will only begin after the hottest phase of the conflict ends. The prime minister has been warning of the impact to the economy as oil prices continue to climb.
The longer this goes on, the more likely the potential for an impact on our economy, impact into the lives and households of everybody and every business. And our job is to get ahead of that, to look round the corner, assess the risk, monitor the risks and work with others in relation to that.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will shortly update MPs on the government's economic response to the conflict. HMS Prince of Wales is now not expected to travel to the region. Speculation that the aircraft carrier was to be deployed grew over the weekend, but Donald Trump says the US doesn't need the UK's help. Lord Dannett, Richard Dannett, is a former head of the British Army. He told Times Radio the suggestion of sending a carrier was incomprehensible.
Frankly, we don't need an aircraft carrier in the Eastern Mediterranean. That's what RAF Akrotiri is. It's our fixed aircraft carrier. We're actually compounding our unpreparedness by talking about sending not just a Type 45 too late, but an aircraft carrier far too late.
At least five members of the Iranian women's football team are reported to have claimed asylum in Australia. It comes after a senior Iranian official branded them traitors after some refused to sing the national anthem before a match at an international tournament. Donald Trump is urging Australia's Prime Minister to grant asylum to the team, posting that it would be a terrible humanitarian mistake to allow them to return home. In other news, the King and Queen have been heckled as they arrived for a Commonwealth Day service at Westminster Abbey. It's Charles and Camilla's first significant public appearance since the arrest of the former Prince Andrew. Counter-terrorism police have charged a 58-year-old man with crimes against humanity and torture against civilians in Damascus. The suspect, who now lives in the UK, worked for the Syrian Air Force Intelligence Department. He's accused of seven offences connected to the uprising in 2011 and is due in court tomorrow. The High Court has heard Gerry Adams was directly responsible for and complicit in IRA bombing decisions. Three victims of attacks in London and Manchester have brought a civil case. They're seeking symbolic damages of £1. Our reporter Kiva Quinn is in Belfast.
In terms of a civil action, it's going to be looking more at whether they can prove or not that there is a possibility that Gerry Adams did have a senior role in the IRA, something that he has always strongly denied. And these proceedings are expected to last over the next several days, so it will be a long case, I think.
And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
John Peanut on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
Hello, I'm John Peanut here with Drive on Times Radio. MPs are about to get an up-to-the-moment briefing on Britain's role in the Iran war. So many questions, so many answers that MPs and the rest of us want to hear. Now, most people back the government in refusing to allow British bases to be used for US attacks on Iran. And then Keir Starmer changed tack and said, OK, use our bases, but just in defence of our allies and assets. Now, and as for going further, as for British forces striking at Iranian military assets that pose a threat, well, most people, more than 9 out of 10 Brits, say no. Ministers, including the Defence Secretary John Healey, who is going to be reporting to MPs shortly, ministers say nothing is ruled out. So will the Defence Secretary be any clearer about that today? And there is a broader question. Are our military forces strong enough? Are they up to the task of making a big difference in the Gulf War, let alone a future major conflict? And will the government take the tough decisions to rearm the UK sufficiently to face the all-too-real threats that seem to loom larger every day? Well, we're going to be listening in to the questions and answers in the House of Commons. We'll be picking out the ones that matter and the ones that we think are going to be most interesting to you. And just as importantly, we'll be picking out the questions that are being ducked and evaded. I wonder what is the biggest question on your mind right now. Do send me a text and tell me, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. And a little later, it is hard, isn't it, to envy the King's job in paying a state visit to the USA and dinner with the President in a few weeks, assuming it goes ahead as discussed. With Anglo-US relations just so rocky, how should the King use his position as honoured guest to smooth over this rough patch in the now not-so-special relationship? We're going to be talking about that a little later too. First, though, talking about many of these questions a little bit earlier on to Lieutenant General Sir Simon Mayall, who was a former Deputy Chief of the Defence Staff and a former Middle East advisor to the government. I asked him, first of all, what he thought of the government's response to the Iran crisis.
Well, it's unfortunate, John. There's no doubt about it. You know, the relationship between the Americans and ourselves is very close. It's been forged on battlefields. It's institutionalized, etc. We've been confronted with a very dangerous situation. It may be a moment of opportunity. We've yet to see how this goes. And it's a great pity to find that the British government has been slow to step up. I would never have argued that we would have volunteered to take part in offensive operations against the Iranians, not at this stage, but I'm rather staggered, I think a lot of commentators have been, that we have been underprepared for what was obviously going to happen, either a capitulation by the Iranians, an Israeli-American strike on the Iranians, and almost certainly as a result of that retaliation, which would bring into jeopardy our interests, our reputation, and more importantly, our citizens and our military assets.
So in what respect then, Simon, do you think that this country, that the British government has been slow to step up?
Well, I'm afraid I feel a lot of it is because of Starmer's poor grip on his own cabinet. I think he was outflanked. His leadership skills have been found wanting. And I think there's an awful lot to do with domestic politics within his party and, dare I say, within the constituencies that support Labour. This is something I cannot believe he was not given advice on by the Ministry of Defence, John Healey, CDS, that we should make provision for the self-defence or the defence of British national assets and, dare I say, reputation.
So we are told, aren't we, that what turned out to be the British government position, which is that Britain is not going to provide the use of our bases for offensive operations, that was based on legal advice and on the absence, as the Prime Minister subsequently described it, of a clear American plan. I mean, could you just address those two points for us? First of all, the legality.
I'm not a lawyer, John, but we're a sovereign nation. We have national interests. One of them, I think, for people like myself, is to look like a reliable ally. Mm. And there are times when it's quite clear one holds up the international card because it serves a sort of national perspective. And this was one of them. And I'm afraid, given what's at stake, what was expected, this is not about caving into pressure from the United States. Mm. There are opportunities when you then leverage and you parlay your support into prosperity, security, and stability objectives that the government own.
Yes.